Hi, Ira here. The year is winding down, almost time to break out the bubbly, but it's not too late to make an end-of-the-year donation to Science Friday. If you liked something we did this year, please head over to sciencefriday.com and click the donate link. It'll set us up for a 2014 filled with more radio, podcasts, and videos. Thank you, and have a happy new year. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. People often ask us about some of our most memorable moments. One of the highlights came way back in 1997. We had planned to talk to neurologist Oliver Sacks about his latest book, The Island of the Colorblind. And at the last moment, we decided to add a second segment to the hour, a conversation with researchers who were hunting for the giant squid. We were worried that Dr. Sacks might be grumpy about having his segment cut short. But his assistant said, "Giant squid? Dr. Sacks loves squid. Can he stay for that interview, too?" And that day, Dr. Sacks showed up for the interview carrying a toy rubber squid and wearing a T-shirt that read, "I Heart Cephalopods." So today we're opening the vault, dialing back to 1997 to bring you that conversation. We won't be taking your calls today.
We're going to be talking about two special topics this hour. I think there's a little relationship between both of them. We're talking about giant squid and tropical islands. And my first guest this hour is neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, who I understand is also interested in squid. And you know Dr. Sacks from the many books he has written. He has a new book out called The Island of the Colorblind, and it's published by Knopf. Let me introduce him formally. He's professor of neurology at the Albert Einstein School of Medicine in New York. And he's author, as I say, of seven books. And his latest is The Island of the Colorblind, published by Knopf. And Dr. Sacks is here with us at in our studios in New York. Welcome back to the program.
It's nice to be here
again. What have you been up to lately? I see you've been traveling since your last visit. Went out to Micronesia.
I went there twice. I'd never been to the Pacific Islands before. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated, amongst other things, by some strange neurological disorders, which are peculiar to them. Mm-hmm. But it was also my first experience of coral atolls and volcanic islands and that mm-hmm. part of the world.
Now, you live on an island in New York. Most New Yorkers don't realize that City Island, which you live in, is part of the Bronx.
Annexed by the Bronx in 1890. It used to be part of Westchester.
And you do your swimming, and you also study nature out there, too, because I know that you, according to your biography, that you raise tropical plants, and a special tropical plant.
My favorite tropical plants are cycads. These are very, very primitive trees which sort of go back before the dinosaurs, and I've had a long love affair with them.
Mm-hmm. Is that love affair something that led you out to the island to look at these?
Yes, it contributed to that, because on Guam, where there's been a very strange, nasty disease for 200 years, one of the suspects are the cycads which grow there, which people eat.
Tell us about that disease, what you were looking at.
The native people, the Chamorros, call it lytico-bodig. Lytico, short for paralytico. It can sometimes take a paralytic form like ALS, mm-hmm. sometimes a form like Parkinsonism or dementia. It's a brute of a disease. It's a killer. At one time, it killed a tenth of the Chamorros. And it reached a sort of peak in the 1940s and 1950s. And there's been a tremendous number of people have sort of tried to solve what's causing it. It's not a genetic disease. Mm-hmm. And people have wondered if there's anything sort of peculiar in the earth, the soil, the food. And as I say, one of the suspects are the cycad trees which grow on the island. Some of the patients who get it seem very similar to my post-encephalitic patients, the mm-hmm. patients I described in Awakenings. They can sort of be motionless and transfixed for a very long while.
Why do they suspect it has to do with the cycad? Now, explain to everybody that this tree is basically like vital to just about every walk of life on the island, right? They have food from it, the medicine in the past.
These are very tough trees, and whenever there's a typhoon or starvation or whatever, these are the only trees which survive. Their seeds are they're huge plum-like seeds. Right. They're very nutritious, but also very toxic. And there has to be a very elaborate preparation you know, other cultures, many other cultures, eat cycad seeds and have learned how to detoxify them and don't come to grief. Mm-hmm. And whether the... But this disease has been getting rarer in the last 30 or 40 years, and cycad eating has also diminished since the Second World War with the Americans entering and wheat and rice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in your book, The Island of the Colorblind, the name of the book, The Colorblind, the island, you also went to an island where, what, 12% of the population is, or more?
It's
colorblind.
I'd heard of this island when I was on Guam, and then I made another visit. Total color blindness.
They see no colors.
No colors.
It's like black and white.
Black and white. This is very rare, like 1 in 50,000. The common red-green color blindness is 1 in 20, at least among men. But on this island, through a sort of genetic freak, and through the fact there was a typhoon in the 1770s, which almost exterminated the population, and then the small residue intermarried, this very rare thing, as you say, affects 10, 12% of the people. And so it occurred to me, I've always, since writing in my last book about a man who lost color vision from a brain injury and first found it absolutely devastating because color was so precious to him, I then wondered what would it be like never to have had color, but to have constructed a visual world other ways. Mm-hmm. And I'd never seen such a person, but here on the island there were, you know, there was 10% of the population like this, almost a community of achromatopes.
How do you deal with the body always compensates somehow, right?
Well, in terms of these people also have some other problems. They have no cones in their eye. They only have the rods which we use for night vision, and they're rather dazzled by daylight, and their detail vision is poorer. But it was obvious that they could identify, say, all the plants on the island. The island is something of a green monochrome. And I had the feeling that their sense of their knowledge of texture and boundary and luminance and so forth was heightened. And they have very, very good night vision. And in a strange way, these people who are seen as partly disabled by day become supremely able by night. So crucial things like the night fishing, which is done with either by the light of the full moon or torches, this has been done by the achromatopes of Pingalap for a century or more. They are superb night fishers.
Yeah, and you brought them hundreds of sunglasses. To be so sensitive to the sun in an island where the sun is there so long.
They do what they can with working in shady places or shady I mean visually shady,
right.
not morally shady.
But were they happy to see the sunglasses you brought them?
They seem to be, although whether, you know, how much society will sort of let them keep it, I don't know. But certainly the immediate impact was delight sometimes. And one could see even with, say, a three-month baby who was showing the symptoms and blinking, squinting.
Yeah.
As soon as one put a little pair of sunglasses on, the baby stopped squinting and squalling and sort of, you know, looked around attentively.
The doctor who invited you to come out there, what was his name?
John Steele.
John Steele.
Yeah.
You write about him as a doctor who you think originally wanted to get away from it all.
I'd had a little correspondence with him many years ago when he was an eminent academic physician and neurologist in Canada. But I think he wanted the island life. He'd read Arthur Grimble's book, A Pattern of Islands, and his big fantasy was to be an island doctor. And soon after that, in the mid-70s, he went first to Hawaii and then to the Caroline Islands and then to Guam.
Did he realize his fantasy, do you think? Was he happy that it turned out the way he thought it would be?
I think so. He lives in a village called Umatic, which is, in fact, where Magellan originally landed in 1521. But he lives in the middle of the community, and it's the most affected community. And he really is a sort of an island practitioner and loves that, although, like everyone else, he has another secret fantasy that he will crack the secret of the Litico Bodig.
Right.
And the feeling is if one cracks that, not only will it be tremendously important in itself, but it may give a clue to many other diseases like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease, which it seems a bit similar to.
Hmm. Do you ever see yourself thinking, gee, I'll trade one island for another, I'll trade City Island for...
I've often wondered about a sort of a stage three in life, and I was very taken by these tropical islands.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also very taken by New Zealand.
New Zealand's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You brought in, we're going to talk in the second half hour about squid, giant squid. And I see you carrying a squid with you. That's another passion of yours, huh?
Yeah, they've been, again, a passion for a very, very long while.
How did that start?
I think it probably started with the Natural History Museum in London, where there was a model of a giant squid, and there were many other squids in spirit and in alcohol. And I've been interested for a long while on the paperback of Anthropologist. I have a cuttlefish on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
On my notepaper, I have a cuttlefish. I carry one around in the car. And, of course, I was very excited when, one of the great mysteries is that no one has ever seen the giant squid or a giant squid.
Mm-hmm. Or no one alive today is.
Oh, yeah, no, is, no, is, yes.
Because
yes.
We do have some pictures of them, I think. Well, we'll find out.
All right.
Do you think in another life that if you were to start over again?
I used to love marine biology.
Yeah.
And one of my closest friends became a marine biologist, and I loved botany. I mean, there's so many... No one has the feeling there are many possible lives one might have taken, but some of the old biological interests are still there.
Yeah. Do you get time from your work? Do you have time off enough of your own free time to explore these other things?
Yes and no. I mean, I still go to my hospital, the Awakenings Hospital. I've gone there for more than 30 years now. Mm-hmm. But I take off when I can. I love scuba diving, and so I like to, and I love rainforests, and they're my two favorite environments.
That's where I want to go next. It's one of the rainforests in Central America, Costa Rica or something. Have you been to?
Yeah.
Yeah, which one have you been to?
Costa Rica, and I'm going to go to Brazil later this year.
Wow.
But they are the two most wonderful and one fears most threatened environments.
Head over to our website at sciencefriday.com for more with Dr. Sachs and a video tour of his desk. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're bringing you some classic tape from the Science Friday vaults, a 1997 conversation with neurologist Oliver Sacks about colorblindness, sea creatures, and more. Head over to our website at sciencefriday.com for more with Dr. Sacks and a video tour of his desk.
You're sitting here wearing a T-shirt with a Portuguese man of war on it. So you really have gone the marine route.
Though interestingly, this ties up with neurology in a way, because very, very important work was done on the learning and brains of the octopus. And I was very fascinated by this. These are very, very smart animals indeed. And, in fact, the first models of the brain were built up from observation of octopus brains.
They are smart, aren't they? Some people consider them the smartest marine organisms, besides dolphin. They're not mammals, but...
Certainly when one's scubaing or whatever, they seem quite different from fish. I mean, they will hover in front of you and they will watch. And
they're sneaky, aren't they? They really plan. They sort of plan things, and they're sneaky.
Yeah. Certainly.
And of course, neurologists have learned a lot from very simple. I'm thinking of Eric Kandel's work with the slugs and things.
Absolutely. And of course, with the squids, these incredibly fast tentacles have giant axons, giant nerves, and this is crucial for physiologists.
Well, let me ask you about that. If you have a squid that's 60 feet long or something like that. There's talk that in the dinosaurs may have had maybe remote brains in their bodies because to get the signals from one end to the other. Could that actually happen in a squid too? Would you need to have a relay station because those signals don't travel so fast?
No, I think you have the fastest transmission in the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
And beside, I think the dinosaurs were given a sort of a bad press, I think. One's realizing now that they were very much more active and intelligent and agile. They weren't these sort of ponderous imbeciles.
Yeah. Yeah, they move around. They're more like birds. It's agile and fast-moving. And
yeah, certainly some of them. Yeah.
And one of the islands that you visited, Pompeii, right, Dr. Sachs? Uh-huh. Legend has it that it was...
built by a giant octopus called Lydekica. And this fascinated me. It was the only cephalopod creation myth I'd ever heard.
Wow.
But they have a real reverence for cephalopods.
I'll bet. What would you like to study now if you could study it?
Well, one of my interests is space, which is sort of...
You told me. You came in wearing this jacket with all these space the patches from all these shuttle launches. Right. You said one of the seeds were what? Tell us about it.
One of my good friends, Marsha Ivins, is an astronaut. She's sort of been up four times in the shuttle. Mm-hmm. I was down in Cape Canaveral for her last sort of launch and landing. And since I love cycads, I asked if it might be possible to give some seeds a ride. And so in the last shuttle, which went up to the Hubble, some cycad seeds were taken up there. And I think I'm due to get the full story this weekend. I think one or two of them may have germinated in space.
Is that right?
So I like to think that these cycads, as well as having sort of floated over ocean currents to all the islands of the Pacific, or many of them, may also have had a little taste of space.
We have to watch how they grow. I mean, if they're germinated in space, who knows what could happen?
Right.
Were they unofficial cargo?
Very unofficial, and maybe I shouldn't have mentioned this.
We won't tell anybody.
We won't tell anybody. It's just between us.
It's between us.
Right.
Is it easy to grow a cycad? I mean, where do you grow them in your home? On a windowsill? They're pretty big plants. They're like palm trees a little bit, right?
They start small.
Yeah.
And I think the early stages are sort of delicate. You mustn't water them too much. I think they like company. They're males and females, and it's sort of nice to have them together. Mm-hmm. One wonders if there are some pheromones or something. They grow best in pairs.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, you can only grow them indoors, and in California or Florida, you can grow them outside.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there are so many people. I feel we should have people talk to you because there's so many people want to talk to you. 1-800-989-8255. We're having a good time here. Mike in Rochester, Minnesota. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Dr. Sachs. I've read most of your books, I think. You seem to have a fascination with people with exotic disorders, and you seem to particularly enjoy some aspect of that personality type that's actually a positive rather than a disorder, like the rug makers on the island, or the Tourette's surgeon, or Temple Grandin. And that's really interesting. What I would ask you to do is to extend that concept toward less exotic disorders like ADD and bipolar. And it seems to me there's the beginnings of a strategy for how society might treat those lesser disorders better.
I don't just see people with exotic disorders.
He does have a whole hospital practice here in New York.
But whatever I see and whomever I see, without denying the problems, I always look for the positive and what one can build up from this. And one can always find positive things and sometimes very unexpected things.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling, Mike. Let's go to Teresa in San Francisco. Hi, Teresa.
Oh, hi.
Go ahead.
Doctor?
Yes.
Yeah, my son was in a little remote village in Nicaragua recently.
Uh-huh.
And he visited a family who have two children with very poor eyesight, two little girls. There's also a boy in the village.
I missed two little girls with what?
Poor eyesight,
sorry, yes.
They hold hands when they walk around and keep one hand in front.
Uh-huh.
There's also a boy in the village. It's a village of only 20 families.
Uh-huh.
There's no way they're going to get wonderful medical care. Is there some possible vitamin or something that could help these children? What is the usual reason for poor eyesight?
There could be so many reasons. If it's it might be genetic, it might be environmental, it might be a vitamin. For example, vitamin A deficiency is endemic in many, many areas.
Could it be the size of the village, like the island had a very small population?
Well, conceivably.
Yeah, this is an island, but yes. It's probably, maybe there's some intermarriage, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Incidentally, the one of the things which was in my mind when I went to the Island of the Colorblind is a wonderful H.G. Wells story, The Country of the Blind, which is where a traveler blunders into a mountain valley and finds a whole community who can't see. And first he thinks he's going to take over as a sighted person. Then he finds they're all beautifully adapted. And but they think there's something wrong with him because of these. He has visions.
You can see. Thanks, Teresa, for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Any new expeditions coming up that you're going to write about as part of a book? Or you didn't go down there with the idea of writing a book when you went to these islands, did you?
No. And even 2 years ago, after I'd been.
Yeah.
And I think when we last met, I didn't think I was going to write a book. But then the memories sort of surfaced again and got me going and got me thinking and reading. And I often find that happens, it's only later that the full impact can hit one.
Let it percolate a while.
Right.
Up there. Let's go to Sam in Seattle. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and then a related question. I was very interested to hear the discussion about the island of the colorblind. I have been since birth profoundly colorblind, and I have no cone function, and my acuity is actually fairly restricted. I have a lot of the symptoms that your speaker was talking about. My eyes are very light sensitive. I have very dark sunglasses made for me that I wear pretty much any time I'm outside, and I have leather shields on the side to block kind of reflected light. But clinically, I have no color vision, according to the fairly sophisticated tests I had done several years ago. But I think I see colors. And I suspect what's going on is I've trained myself that the sort of different shading or intensity of light that some people see as blue or green or red, that I can make those distinctions to some extent in intensity, and I've trained myself that other people think that's blue or green or yellow, and I sort of, my mind sees it as yellow, but I'm clearly not seeing it, I assume, as other people see colors. But I don't perceive that I live in a totally monochromatic world with shades of black and white and gray, although there are some colors that I just can't distinguish, like a blue and a green, or a black and a red that have very similar depth of color are completely washed out to me, and I can't distinguish them. But again, clinically, based on the tests that I've done, they say I'm profoundly colorblind.
That's very, very interesting. I think one could certainly learn to infer a probable color from a mixture of the particular shade and the context. Certainly sort of the saturated greens and reds would look almost black, and the blues and yellows would tend to look very, very pale. But I agree, our word color blindness or monochrome doesn't suit people who just know that they have a very rich world and not one which can be defined reductively like this. There are some conditions in which there may be some functional cones and perhaps a hint of colour, and it may be that this gentleman in Seattle. And by the way, have you been in touch with the Achromatopsia Network?
No, I have not.
Oh, because I mentioned this at the end of my book. There's a marvellous woman in Berkeley, Frances Futterman, who has reached out to achromatopes all over the world, and she has a website.
Huh.
And
do you know what the website is?
it's on the back of my book.
Well, while you're talking, I'll find it.
Right. Because people with this is a very rare and sometimes isolating and misunderstood condition, and people with this now, there are some hundreds of them all over the world who are in contact with each other, and they can share information and strategies and perspectives and you should know about this.
What's her name?
Her name is Frances Futterman. I'm going to look at the same time as you do. It should be on the very. Oops, maybe just before the index. Should have had this.
I was wondering while you're looking, did the folks on the island who you studied, what was their perception? Not their clinical perception, but their kind of. Subjective perception of their whether they were seeing colors or things in different colors.
I don't think they had any thought of this. They were sort of puzzled by color language, although they would learn to use various terms. Occasionally, you know, one asked some of these people, if it were possible, would you like colour? The usual answer was that this was a meaningless question. Mm-hmm. And most of them sort of indicated they felt their worlds were complete and they wouldn't know what to do with colour. Mm. And asked the sort of question, people would say, well, would you like X-ray vision? And one would say, no, thanks, I'm fine as I am. And they say, sure, so are we. So I think the lack of colour, you know, if it's been from birth, is not felt as a loss.
The Achromatopsia Network, it's in Berkeley, at www.achromat.org. So you can find it there, either way. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Head over to our website at sciencefriday.com for more with Dr. Sacks and a video tour of his desk.
I'm Ira Flatto, and you're listening to Science Friday from NPR. A lot of people, I guess very few people have no people who are. They normally think red-green colorblind is it. They don't know very many people who are profoundly colorblind.
No, well, I mean, I mean most neurologists or ophthalmologists will never meet an achromatope. This is extremely rare. But still, you know, if you multiply the population of the world, sort of, you know, if you divide it by 50,000.
Yeah, you know. If you see enough people, sooner or later you'll see everything.
Yeah, right. By chance I have some, I thought of this when the lady spoke about the children in Nicaragua, but just near me in the West Village I see a little boy and girl, a brother and sister with sort of dark red glasses, and I've got to know them now, and they are achromatopes. They have been fascinated by the story of the island, and I think they want to go there and sort of look up their brothers and sisters.
You think working in New York, where there are so many people, you get to see a lot? I mean, that's helpful for a physician to see all these different kinds?
Yeah, I think you see, in a way, you see almost everything here, though you also need to go out and make special visits, because you need to see people in their context.
Yeah.
And what was so important here was seeing these people, as you say, on a tropical, though monochrome island,
right,
where in fact they have a certain cultural place.
Huh. Are you going to hang with us for a while? We're going to talk about giant squid?
If I may, I
would. Oh, be our guest. So as I said, we're going to talk to the leader of a project to look and find those giant squid. The giant squid has been the source of all kinds of stories, sailor stories for centuries, but, you know, we know very little about them, and now a group of scientists in New Zealand is trying to change all that. They're sailing off the coast of South Island in the Kakuru Canyon, and their goal is to find and photograph a fabled giant squid. Clyde Roper is the leader of that expedition and the zoologist at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History, and he joins me now by phone from Kaikoura, New Zealand. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be with you.
You know, is this a mythical sea creature? Do giant squid really exist?
The answer is yes, in a sense, because they certainly are the basis of many, many myths that go back hundreds and hundreds of years. But in fact, these are animals that do exist. We know they exist. We have specimens of them. The mystery here really is that we know absolutely nothing about their biology and habitat and behavior. We know a little bit about their anatomy simply from examining dead specimens. The point is that no specimen has ever been seen alive in its natural habitat.
And how do you know where to look for one then?
Well, by detective work, after all, and I think Dr. Sacks will agree that being a scientist is very much like being a detective. And so we just put together bits and pieces of data that have accumulated over the years, and I've determined that this area in New Zealand would be an area of high potential for finding living giant squid.
Why would you choose that area in New Zealand?
Well, this area was chosen because for three main reasons. One is that there are a number of records in the literature and in newspapers and so forth of giant squids or bits and pieces of giant squid that have washed ashore. These are called strandings, or what we call floaters, have been found floating at the surface of the sea. Part of the reason for many of the floating evidences from sperm whales, this area is inhabited year-round by sperm whales, and sperm whales are a major predator on giant squid. We know that, for example, from looking at the stomach contents of sperm whales that have themselves been stranded, or back in the days when they were hunted, the beaks or mouth parts of giant squid have been found in their stomachs. And thirdly, this area is a region for one of the deepest commercial fisheries in the world, deep-sea commercial fisheries for orange roughy, hokey and scampi, and occasionally, just occasionally in the last decade or so, specimens of giant squid have been caught in these very deep-sea fishing nets. So this combination of evidence indicates to me and to colleagues that it's a prime area for finding giant squid.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. We're bringing you some classic tape from the Science Friday vaults, a 1997 conversation about the search for the giant squid. I'm talking with Clyde Roper, a zoologist at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, and neurologist Oliver Sacks is sitting in on the interview.
So how do you search for it? Do you go scuba diving? Do you have little robotic cameras? What do you do to look for one?
Well, certainly not scuba diving. unless you have a gigantic tank. We're using basically three approaches here. The giant squid we know is a deep sea animal.
So it lives far down.
It
lives in very deep water. Then.
It lives in very deep water, and honestly, that's about all we know about its habitat. We know it's deep. We make some other assumptions, which might or might not be correct. But the first phase that we have used and is now just completed is using a little robotic submersible, that is a mini submarine that does not take people. This is called the Odyssey, and that was developed and operated by a team of colleagues from Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Mm-hmm. And this was a marvelous little machine that can go to depths of over 6,000 meters. But in our case, we worked in waters from 200 to 750 meters. And in the nose of this little vehicle was a highly sensitive deep-sea video camera. The vehicle also recorded data for temperature, depth, salinity,
right,
and various parameters like that. The vessel was not attached in any way to the surface ship. It was given instructions in its little brain or computer on board with an onboard navigational system as well. And at the beginning of each mission, the details of the dive were entered into the computer. The vehicle went down and did its job and came back again.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you're going to be using on this?
We have already used that.
Yeah.
That phase is completed. There are two other phases of the expedition. One is using what's called a rope cam, and this is a digital video equipment installed in a frame that is lowered towards the bottom of the sea, and suspended on a rope, and with an anchor usually, or we can let it drift as well. And this is being done primarily by a team from National Geographic, and that also has incorporated with it a baiting system, either bait fish that's attached out in front of the camera, or a system of little barrels that are filled with bait, chum, if you will, fluid, liquid bait, which is pumped out into the deep sea. And the idea here, of course, is to attract organisms into the range of the camera.
But you're not going to try to catch one, are you?
No. The objective certainly is not to try to catch a giant squid. The point here is to try to capture it on film, to try to get an idea of what it looks like in its natural habitat, how it moves, what its orientation is,
right,
and these sorts of bits of information that we have no idea of at this point.
Now, you also have what I understand is a critter cam. This is an interesting idea. You're going to put a camera on a sperm whale's head?
Yes, indeed. The critter cam is a fascinating little instrument that is attached to the head of sperm whales. This is developed by a fellow at National Geographic Television. And they're working with the group down here called Whale Watch Kaikoura. That's the whale watching group out of the Kaikoura region. And the objective here is to place the camera on the head of a sperm whale, and sperm whales dive to great depths. And among their prey are cephalopods, squids mostly, deep sea squids, and including giant squid, which must be a favorite meal for a sperm whale because the giant squids are so large. It makes sense from the standpoint of energy to catch one great big squid rather than several hundred small squid to make up that amount of weight and volume.
I saw there was mentioned in one news report that possibly you might be taking a mini submarine to go after one of these giant squids.
Oh, absolutely. That's the next phase, what we call phase three of this three-phase expedition that started last summer, northern summer, in the Azores, the islands off in the mid-Atlantic Ocean. This phase right now being phase two. Phase three will be next year using a small research submarine called a submersible. That actually will hold four people. The sub that we're working with is called the Johnson Sea Link, operated out of Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institution in Florida. This will be a multidisciplinary expedition with many biologists and geologists working for up to 3 months, and included in this will be the continuing search for living giant squid.
Aren't you afraid of what happened to Dr. Nemo, that you get tangled up by the giant squid and that it might actually be a danger to life and limb?
Well, not really. It, of course, made a great story and a great scene in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. But
they're not vicious, and they wouldn't attack you if they felt threatened.
Well, we of course really don't know because no one has seen one alive in its natural habitat. There are many stories, and some giant squid have reportedly been seen at the surface alive, and have attacked boats and ships. But I suspect these animals, if in fact they were alive at the surface, might have been very nearly dead, or certainly on their way out, and their arms and tentacles might have thrashed around a bit. But it's hard for me to imagine that an animal whose natural habitat is several hundred to several thousand meters deep is going to be comfortable in attacking ships at the sea surface.
Well, Dr. Sachs, you want to go on that submarine?
I would love to. I'm almost as much as I'd like to go on the space shuttle, actually possibly more. Actually, curiously, I anticipating today, I read Peter Benchley's Beast last night, where, of course, the giant squid, the Architeuthis, takes on a sort of a monstrous sort of ferocity. I know there are some squids, like Humboldt squid, which are very muscular and can be quite aggressive. Mm-hmm. But I sort of get the feeling that this is a fairly weakly muscled creature, which sort of ambles along. But who knows?
Well, if you compare the muscular tissue, let's just say in the body wall, which is called the mantle, the Humboldt squid, of course, is an extremely powerfully muscled animal. The muscle is very thick and tough and powerful. We've made many observations on their swimming ability. There is, of course, at least one authenticated report of an attack on humans, on a diver, by these Humboldt squid. You compare that with the tissue in a giant squid, and you'll notice that the giant squid tissue is much more loosely consolidated. It has sort of a semi-gelatinous matrix in it, so it's not nearly as thick and powerful looking as a Humboldt squid or many of the shallow water oceanic squid. So it probably isn't that powerful a swimmer. But then again, it probably doesn't need to be. It's a huge animal. The largest ever measured is around 60 feet total length. That includes the two long feeding tentacles. So they are massive animals, but they probably don't have to move extremely rapidly. As far as we know, the only predator when they get up to be over a certain length would be the sperm whales themselves.
Uh-huh. Tony in San Antonio. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Aerith. Thanks for taking my call. I saw in one of those, unknown or amazing books, Japanese, fishing boat accidentally caught what they thought was a giant squid. It's pretty much decomposed and white, and I was wondering if your guest knew anything about that. And the second question to that would be, if they did find out if that was really a squid, how old would it be, or how old can it survive?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, because giant squid, as I mentioned, are found occasionally at the surface, and of course are found in fishing nets occasionally. It very well could have been a giant squid, although if it's the report I'm thinking of, there are many other, let's say, undescribable bits and pieces, or sometimes huge pieces of organisms, organic material found at sea. Most of the time, these end up being perhaps of long dead sperm whales, usually sperm whales, and oftentimes these are washed ashore and they bear the name of the such and such monster or the such and such blob.
Right.
And in fact, they are very, very old. Tissue, mostly connective tissue of various sorts from long dead sperm whales. So that possibly is an explanation for the giant squid on the Japanese ship, especially if it was white. A giant squid, its natural coloration is quite a dark, lovely maroon color, maroonish red color. Mm. But of course, if found floating, the skin easily could have deteriorated and rubbed off.
I have a question about what happens in phase three when you go looking for this squid. You know, in wildlife surveys, they usually tag an animal and let it go back. Would you be thinking of tagging squids so you can see where they go and how deep they live and following them around the sea?
Well, that certainly would be an interesting and desirable thing to do. We now have tags that would be suitable not only for simply following them around, tracking them, but also for inserting them and getting an idea of their expenditure of energy and this sort of thing. That would be lovely if we could do that, if we could actually approach a giant squid and implant a small tracking device on it. So that's one of the things in the works. One of the other things that I'd like to mention is that the giant squid really has become, for many, many children and students, sort of the new dinosaur in the last several years. And I get many calls and emails and letters from children who are excited about giant squid. Mm. When I say the new dinosaur, of course, every child is interested in dinosaurs, and now there's been a bit of a replacement activity here, and some of them switching over to giant squids. And for that reason, I look at the giant squid as sort of an icon for understanding or introduction to the entire deep sea ecosystem. And if we can get children interested in the oceans and in the deep sea through this particular icon, I think that's a very beneficial way to spark science and math in students, young students.
Yeah.
And along those lines, next year we're hoping to have, with the help of a colleague from NASA, direct satellite links between the submarine and the tender ship, with the satellite and then beaming into electronic classrooms all over not only over the United States, but anywhere in the world where these distance learning centers can be established. So I think this is a marvelous opportunity to bring children and adults as well along on a major exciting research expedition.
I'm Ira Flatow, and you're listening to Science Friday from NPR.
See, Dr. Sachs will be able to talk to him by satellite. We'll have to get you in a classroom someplace.
Right.
Well, it would be lovely to have Dr. Sachs come along with us, and we have many volunteers. And when he mentioned about going into the submersible, it's interesting. We have.
I've never seen a guest drool before in my studio.
Well, the people react two ways when talking about going into the submersible. They're either very, very, very enthusiastic, excited, want to go in, or they just do not want to go near it. You couldn't for all the giant squid in the world, or some people who certainly wouldn't get into the
pretty claustrophobic
into the submersible.
Yeah. And so you say that, but first you got to find one, right? This expedition is basically to just see if you can find the squid.
That's right. Of course, that's That's one of the objectives of this expedition, and it's sort of the hook for folks to become interested in it. Mm-hmm. But we're really interested in finding the relationship between sperm whales and giant squid, to try to learn the ecosystem where this interrelationship occurs, and to try to understand and gain information and knowledge about this deep sea ecosystem where these two huge animals occur. All of these data will be important for applying to our planning and approach to the next phase with the manned submersible.
Yeah, Dr. Saxon.
I have to say that some of my sympathies are with the giant squid, and I'm wondering whether you feel they can ever sort of defend themselves appreciably against a sperm whale.
Well, that's interesting, and of course there are many, many stories and myths about giant squid battling sperm whales, and this has been witnessed at the surface of the sea. I must say, they do have a good defense, because they certainly, if they're like all the rest of the cephalopods that we know about, they are very well equipped. They have excellent eyesight. They are able to sense the approach of potential predators and potential nets, perhaps a fishing net. So with a few squirts, a few jets, if they can perceive the enemy, they would be able to escape. Obviously not all of them do, but clearly all of them do not get captured either. So our sympathies can be with the sweet little giant squid. On the other hand, it's part of life, and certainly part of the life of the sperm whales to be able to feed themselves as well.
I had another question, which I think was perhaps already asked, about how long these things can live.
Yeah.
I was amazed and sort of rather sad when I saw some big cuttlefish to hear that they'd achieved their size and then died within 2 years.
Oh.
And how does the big squid get its size, and how long does it live?
Well, very little is known, but a wee bit of research done indicates that these animals reach their gigantic size of over a ton in perhaps 3 years or less. And this is really quite staggering for these huge, magnificent animals.
Clyde Roper, thank you I know you took time out from your day of looking for the squid to talk with us. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And good luck.
Good luck. Clyde Roper is a zoologist at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History in Washington. Also, thank you, Oliver Sacks, for sitting in with me on this one.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you.
Oliver Sacks' new book is The Island of the Colorblind, published by Knopf, and he is a professor of neurology, of course, at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York.